From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. How can we succeed in an uncertain world? Nassim Nicholas Taleb identifies a category of things that not only depend on disorder, they thrive on it. For example, human bones get stronger when subjected to stress. Taleb spoke about this concept that he calls anti-fragile on December 12, 2012, at Seattle's Town Hall.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. I'm very honored to be here. You know, this is my last leg of the book tour. I don't know if you've been on a book tour, but it's not easy. And now I can understand why politicians lose brain cells going from city to city, saying different things. You get the idea. Anyway, so this is exactly the last leg of the book tour. So therefore, you know, I'm much more relaxed than I was last night in San Francisco and the day before in London. It's crazy. So if I fall asleep or, you know, jet lag or something happens to me, fire an angry question and you see how, you know, everything will come back, all right? So I guess the idea is that I talk about the book and then we have a Q&A, but we can, you know, if you have an urgent question or you're very angry, don't hesitate. I'm here to answer your thing. So anti-fragile. My bio, as I overheard my bio from far, seems interesting, but it's not very accurate and by design. My real bio is, for those who know me, I was an option trader for 20 years. And when you're an option trader, you understand two things, volatility and drinking. You know what I'm saying? So the volatility part is split in half. About half of the things around you are harmed by volatility, and the other half benefits from volatility. Very simple, no? So hence this book, Things That Benefit from Volatility. When you ask people, even in Seattle, what's the opposite of fragile? First of all, there was no definition of fragile, you know, so we'll have to redefine it. But when you ask them, what's the opposite of fragile, what do they answer? Sorry, robust. What else? Durable. Stable. All these words that have absolutely nothing to do with, of course, the opposite of fragile. All right. So let's imagine exactly the mathematical definition of the opposite of fragile as follows. If I'm sending a package to southwestern Mongolia, because there's a cousin of mine has his wedding, and you send the package, right? You write fragile on it. And then to explain what fragile means, what would you write underneath? Handle with care. Very good. So the people, you know, the post office between here and Mongolia would know what to do with it. Okay? Handle with care, they understand, right? So what would the opposite of handle with care be? Well, simple, okay? So that was, yeah? Sorry? No, the opposite of handle with care is please mishandle, all right? So, or mishandle, all right? But, you know, it'd be with some polite, you know, just to be nice, all right? So that's the opposite of fragile. And effectively, you know, in Seattle, what's the opposite of convex? Concave, all right, very good. The opposite of negative, positive, in Seattle, all right, that also applies. I tried it in San Francisco, the same, all right. So when you map mathematically, fragility, it is the concave. So therefore, the negative of the concave is the convex. So therefore, the negative of fragility is something that has exactly opposite attributes to the fragile. It has to benefit from harm. So the robust is not the opposite of fragile, right? That's the problem. There was no word for the opposite of fragile, although there were some expressions. Now, for example, let's go to mythology. The Greeks had the equivalent of robust, and can someone name the mythological bird? Phoenix. You shoot phoenix, it comes back the same. See, the robust is not improved from harm, but it's not harmed. So Phoenix, now what's really the opposite of the fragile, something that benefits from harm in Greek mythology? Hydra, you cut one head to grow back. That's it. So if you're Hydra, you want to be harmed. You know, you want more heads. You know, I mean, it's costly to feed a lot of heads, but nevertheless, you know, you want more heads. So this is the the topic of the book. But let me explain the connection to volatility. Now that I have a glass of water, last lecture it was in plastic, so I couldn't do the experiment. This is fragile because if I put it on this table, it does not want any volatility at all. It's harmed by anything. So the upper bound is unharmed. There's nothing that can happen in this room. Say, an attack by the Martians, you know, they come on Earth, or the Russians, you know, you never know with the Russians. Or whatever happens, an earthquake, a fight, whatever it is, it can either be unharmed or harmed. You see, it will not benefit from that event. So therefore, it doesn't like volatility. It wants peace and predictability. So therefore, you can map the fragile into what likes order, peace, predictability. And the anti-fragile is what likes disorder, variability, volatility, harm, stressors, and all of these. You can mathematically map time. Time actually mathematically is mapped typically as volatility, because the more time, the more things happen, the more variability. So this is sort of the idea of the book, and you classify the world in three categories: fragile, robust, anti-fragile. The things that are robust, the Brooklyn Bridge. I don't know if you have bridges here, you know, but and I think I've been on a bridge, right? That's robust. It doesn't improve from, if you get on it, you know, it doesn't improve, okay? The fragile, we know what the fragile is. This glass breaks. And the anti-fragile would be the organic equivalent of the bridge. You ride on it, it gets better. I don't know, you never know with Seattle, you know, what you may do with bridges, but typically the physical, the thing that is engineered doesn't improve from use. Okay, so at best it can be robust. The anti-fragile, it corresponds to the organic, your body. This is why I say I talk about a mistake of mistaking the cat for the washing machine. See, the washing machine doesn't improve from use. Anything organic, your body requires some stressors, otherwise you age. You have something called atrophy. So, and effectively, it converts stressors into information about the future environment by overreacting. If you go in the sun, you get, you know, your skin will predict, if you have a Mediterranean complexion, will predict more sun in the future, and will go ahead of the curve by getting more protection than needed. If I lift 100 pounds at the gym, my body prepares itself for 110 pounds. So it sort of uses the stressor as information about the environment. And of course, the biggest mistake is one made, say, by Greenspan, of not realizing that the organic needs stressors. So if you deprive the organic of stressors and harm, the antifragile needs some disorder or some variability as fuel. If you don't give it fuel, it weakens. This is why, I don't know if you have bones in Seattle, but most people have bones elsewhere, what I asked. They require stressors. You get on a bicycle, you're not going to do very well. You need to walk, pound the pavement, jump, lift pianos, whatever it is, all right, to stress your bones, because they want stress. If you don't give them stress, they can become brittle. If you go spend Christmas in a space shuttle, you know, no gravity for a while, and you come back to Earth, you'll definitely have to call the hospital after a while with some bone surgeon to come fix it. You get weaker. So that's sort of the idea of the book.
Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the author of Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 12, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Nassim Nicholas Taleb in a moment. 816 94.9 KUOW. A UNICEF worker in Jordan describes how a winter storm has created havoc in a Syrian refugee camp. Also, Quebec resident Kim Nguyen talks about his Oscar-nominated film about a child soldier. In the midst of Turkish peace talks, the bodies of three Kurdish women are found at the Paris office of the Kurdistan Information Center. And a conversation with Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield on board the International Space Station, all tonight at 11. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight. Lows around 30. Rain and snow showers likely this evening. Partly cloudy after midnight. For Friday, it's highs around 40. Mostly sunny skies. Friday night, lows around 30 again. Partly cloudy. Saturday highs again around 40. Mostly cloudy. Chance of snow flurries.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. There are certain things in this world that thrive on disorder. For example, a riot intensifies when someone tries to suppress it. This is the argument of Nassim Nicholas Taleb, an essayist and scholar whose work focuses on probability and uncertainty. He's the author of the new book, Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. Taleb spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 12, 2012.
Now, I'm going to describe how I wrote the book. I wrote it by layers of, depths. I don't like books that can be summarized easily. It has seven topics. My idea is if you can summarize it in Cliff Notes, then write a Cliff Note equivalent and 14 pages, whatever it is, and then sell it on Amazon and everybody's happy, all right? So here you're going to take the idea to its natural conclusion in every single domain you can think of. That's your book. To confuse reviewers, and I've done it with the two previous books, there's no connection between the titles and the content, all right? So they have to be forced to read it. For example, let me give you an idea. Here, there's something I say, Why Not to Marry the Rock Star. That's the title. Visibly, you can't predict. So people who want to read it very quickly have trouble, because they want to make their $500 to write a book review, so they get very frustrated, and I've had fun with them with my previous books, and it's strange that every book they fall into the trap. So you make sure that they have no way of understanding the book unless they've read it, like you read a Russian novel. Sometimes you skip a page, you miss a point. So that's how I write things. And, of course, the subtitles, there's a chapter title and then subtitles, and the subtitles are even more confusing, all right? When I talk, hey, it's Wednesday, I must be vegan, all right? The architecture and neomania, all right? This, they may get an idea, but when I say I've had traffic in New York, they have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about. The green lumber fallacy, okay? Or, what else? Ms. Bray, who's a fortune teller, has competitors, right? These are subsections of the book. So I've done the same with my previous books. And, of course, that way you clean up your readership of people who shouldn't be reading them, or people who should be reading, all right? That's the way to do it. And it worked. So people complain, but, that's the idea. You can't have a two-minute manager, you can't read it that way. So this is how it's organized. So this idea of anti-fragile versus fragile, I have seven different, I call them books. There were sections, but I call them books because they're standalone books that deal with every aspect of the topic. As I said, I want to go as deep as I can, and in depths, you have layers in a book. And you try to make it entertaining with stories and the characters like Fat Tony, who, as his name indicates, is a fun person, but he comes from New Jersey. And people from New Jersey called Fat Tony tends to be very opinionated. And in general, they're also born in Brooklyn. It's always weird because a lot of people from New Jersey were born in Brooklyn or claim to be born in Brooklyn, but they're not, that kind of thing. So there are characters like Fat Tony in the book. So I will rapidly discuss each one of the books, you know, sub-books, in other words, each one is a section, and what they deal with. The first one deals with evolution and the notion of anti-fragility. Visibly, the first, you know, thing you think about when you understand things, systems gained from stressors is evolution. Evolutionary pressure benefit from randomness. If you have 10 offspring, the environment is stable, the 10 will in turn have offspring, no? So you had no selection pressures. If you have randomness in the environment, you have selection pressures. So evolution likes stressors. Evolution is anti-fragile up to a point. And I apply that to different domains. In economic life, if you didn't have high failure rate in a restaurant business, you'd be eating... I don't know if you've been to Soviet Russia during the Soviet Russian days, but they should probably keep the food around so you could taste it, just in case you have... You want to understand evolution, right? So why things cannot be done top-down. So there's this notion of how systems with failure rate at the lower level do very well at the upper level, and what we should be doing about it. You see, you know, the entrepreneurs fail. This is why the computer industry is phenomenal, or the technology, and you guys are benefiting from it. But it's not good for entrepreneurs. So we have to make sure that we encourage people to take risks for the sake of the system and bail them out in case of failure. Don't bail out the bankers, bail out the failed entrepreneurs, okay, to encourage them to, so people take more risks. So people who wouldn't take risk otherwise do take more risk. So that's sort of my book one. And I explain, okay, there's of course some history, how the Romans had a notion of things get stronger under stress. They understood it rather well, and they even were smart enough to understand two different categories. The first category is mithridatization, where you take a poison every day, a little bit of poison. I don't encourage doing it, but in case you have someone wants to poison you or in your household, like Nero's mother, the Emperor Nero's mother. Nero, she killed her husband by poisoning, so she knew about the tricks. And her son tried to poison her, a very colorful family. And she visibly took a little bit of poison every day, only to discover that you can't really develop immunity against swords. All right, so it's always interesting how people can develop robustness in the wrong domain. So that's sort of like book one, where I have these anecdotes. I also talk about things that get stronger from under pressure, rumors. Try to repress a rumor. Go up and stand up and or listen. You know, when I was a trader, it was phenomenal. I would say that there'd be no devaluation until the Italian minister of finance would say no devaluation. All right. The minute he would say rumors of devaluation are false, we consider that it's, you know, the minute they deny the rumor, it means it's real. If they ignore it, you know, it's not credible. All right. Or riots. Or something called, there's a brand of love called, stubborn love, where the more you try to repress it, the worse it gets. And I look at the literature for these characters. So that's book one, where I introduce the idea through systems, through anecdotes, through stuff like that. Book one. Book two, I go a little beyond by discussing a disease called interventionism, where you try to make everything, that modernity, you know, post-enlightenment, we have this idea that we should control our environment and make everything smooth, which is very nice. We'd like to be smooth, provided it increases our safety. It does not increase our safety. If you spend 6 months in bed or 6 years in bed, it'd be very smooth for you, but it won't increase your safety, because the minute you get out of bed, you're going to be more in trouble than ever before. It's the same thing with some stabilization. I call them pseudo-stabilization. Look at Egypt. The U.S. government stabilized Egypt from the top. It was smooth. For 40 years, nothing happened. And look what happened. Same with Syria. So there are systems that are stabilized beyond what's necessary, and they get weaker from that. Just like someone who spends, again, Christmas with zero gravity. It's very good for your bones, maybe, except when you come back to Earth, you face reality, you'll pay the price. So Alan Greenspan, if you've heard of him, I don't know if you've heard of him, people still talk about him, tried to eliminate the seasons in the economy by saying, okay, it's going to be spring year-round, all right? No more ups and downs, we don't want that. Temperature at 70 degrees year-round. So that's what he declares. It's sort of the equivalent for the economy. And, of course, he fragilized the economy. So I call these people fragilista. All right? And here you invented the word barista, I think, and I think they may ask for... Starbucks never asked me for copyright. And, of course, there's a problem. Whenever you over-intervene... you also under-intervene when necessary. And there's a lot of evidence for that. And, of course, you know, you run out of resources when you intervene all the time to be there when needed. So emergency room surgery is not there. So that's sort of like my book, too. Book three, I talk about prediction. And why this classification is very potent, because you don't have to understand the future. You have to realize one thing and wake up to the following fact. True, we can put a man on the moon. Probably we can put maybe a collection. This town hall, we can move it to Mars and have lectures once in a while. You could probably do that. It is a linear, predictable domain. But there's no... You can put all the scientists of the world together, and they won't predict the stock market close tomorrow morning, open tomorrow morning, okay? And you can predict the weather. I don't know about Seattle. It's not like you have to make an effort. But you can predict the weather in the linear short term. You can't predict the climate, you see, where you have non-linearities. The non-linear domain is unpredictable. And let's not, and economic variables. If you saw the economic predictions made by the Office of Management and Budget, some of you would start by laughing, but we'll all end up crying because it's our money, right? You see, so you realize, so instead of predicting and claiming we understand the future while we don't and fooling ourselves, we can measure fragility. And we can also measure anti-fragility. We can measure robustness. So I talk about that. And, of course, we have Fat Tony who enters, who, for him, the two kind of people, because he's from New Jersey, and he's not a very elegant fellow. His buddy, Nero Tulip, is a little better, but still. Fat Tony smells fragility. And he said, he who predicts the future is a sucker. He's going to blow up because he's going to end up taking more risk. And Fat Tony makes sure that if he blows up, he's there to take his money by shorting his stock, whatever it is. So that's Fat Tony. After Fat Tony, another character enters, who's dominant in the book, called Seneca, the Roman philosopher Seneca. And he had a definition for anti-fragility. Very simple. If you have more upside than downside, you are anti-fragile. If you have more downside than upside, you are fragile. And he realized that Seneca was a philosopher, a Stoic philosopher, but he was Roman, not Greek, which is central. In other words, he didn't deal with stars and cosmos. And he dealt with practical matters and was not ashamed of dealing with practical matters. So he understood that being very wealthy, he was the wealthiest man in the world, by the way, he had a lot of downside. Tomorrow, what happened during these days. And actually, he was right, because he eventually ended up being forced to commit suicide by Nero, right? So, he lost everything later. But he was prepared every day Toulouse, he said, I'm very wealthy. I have no upside for more wealth. If they take it away from me, look at this downside. So every morning, he woke up despising wealth and considering himself very poor, playing mind games, so to take out the sting of impoverishment, you see. And it worked for him. So he would fake like being in a sea wreck and stuff like that, you see. So but he understood that you should be in a position where you always have no downside from random events, psychologically, all right, and have more upside from them. He picked up, he discovered antifragility. Okay, Stoic philosophy, according to textbook, isn't what you'd read by reading the original. It's just like academics talk to each other and they get lost. Plus, they're academics, they don't like risk. They don't really understand that someone may want to have more upside than downside. So we have a seamless evolution from Fat Tony to Seneca, who's vastly, you know, more literate than Fat Tony, but they all understood more upside than downside is what you need to have in life. So you wake up in the morning, you have to fear nothing, not poverty, nothing, because you're prepared for it. This is book three. Book four, and then I have recommendation in book three, too trivial for here, like why not to marry a rock star, why you should put your portfolio in both a combination of very, very low risk and very, very high risk rather than medium risk and stuff like that. Why you should walk and sprint, not jog, stuff like that. Yeah, things that flow from it. And I won't bore you with the details, but, you know, it's fun to discover. Book four is about lecturing birds how to fly. Okay, so effectively, you live in a town that's driven by technology, I assume, no? And here you have two stories. The technologists, since the Industrial Revolution, know that there's a bunch of tinkerers, typically high school, not high school, maybe university dropout, generally high school dropout in the UK, who play with things and discover. And they know how to, they have more upside than downside, they game uncertainty, so to speak. They benefit from volatility because they have very little to lose. Okay, this is a story, you have the thinkers. The problem is they don't write books. Who writes books? Academics, they got nothing else to do but writing books, all right? So I'm now an academic, I realize. So their spin is that technology comes from science. Nonsense. A lot of the things we believe come from science come from tinkerers and engineers who didn't know how to write books. They know how to do things. And, of course, science comes from technology, whereas the story is that technology comes from science. And so I look at this arrow. This is very important because anti-fragile tinkering is how you probe uncertainty by when you have little downside and a lot of upside. And what are the implication and policy from that? And you can and so this is there's quite a bit of a debunking of this notion that you need academia. Or academia is very good if you have children between the age of say 18 and 23, and you want them out off the streets. It's a great place, you know, to do things like that. And education is very nice, but I'd rather have library education rather than this regimented academic education. And you can show that effectively the results coming from top down, I call it Soviet Harvard approach, has been very poor. The results coming from tinkering are much bigger. And people don't like it, but effectively you can see that if rich countries have high degree of education, okay, it doesn't mean that they got rich because of education. Typically education comes later, much later. The era of causality. It's only for families that education is good. It stabilizes the income. You make fortune in the stock market and you don't have a good dinner conversation. You over-educate your children and now you're going to have stable income and be excellent at dinner conversation with other people. So that's how it works.
Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the author of Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 12, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to KUOW.org. www.kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Nassim Nicholas Taleb in a moment, 836, 94.9 KUOW. This year's flu season is severe, and it started early. A conversation about how it compares to previous years and what flu vaccines can and cannot do. That's tonight at midnight. Washington State's six public college presidents have a deal for the legislature. They'd hold back on tuition increases for 2 years, and in return, the legislature would spend $225 million more on higher education. Will legislators agree? Governor Gregoire's proposed budget didn't include tuition increases or more funding. University of Washington President Michael Young says the colleges have been damaged by the loss of half their state support. Adding to their woes is the mandate from the state Supreme Court that the legislature must amply fund K-12 education. That might mean even less money going to public colleges. A conversation about funding higher education in 2013 with UW President Michael Young. That's tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight, lows around 30. Rain and snow showers likely this evening, partly cloudy after midnight. Friday highs around 40, mostly sunny. Friday night lows around 30, partly cloudy. Saturday highs around 40, mostly cloudy this time, with a chance of snow flurries. Marie Walsh tells the story of her incarceration, escape, and new identity as recounted in her book, A Tale of the Two Lives, the Susan Lefebvre fugitive story. Also, Seattle comedians John Keister, Pat Cashman, and Chris Cashman talk about their new TV sketch comedy show, The 206. By many estimates, the successor to the popular Almost Live, which aired on Seattle TV from 1984 to 1999. And Jason Knight, co-founder of Alderleaf Wilderness College in Monroe, Washington, and director of the school's wilderness certification program, has suggestions for outdoor adventurers to stay prepared and avoid emergencies all next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Nassim Nicholas Taleb is an essayist and scholar whose work focuses on probability and uncertainty. His new book is called Antifragile: Things That Gain from Disorder. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 12, 2012. Next, he talks about a concept called via negativa.
Via negativa is knowledge by the negative. And I start with Orthodox theology. And of course, they have this approach at some point of you can't really define what God is, but you can tell what he's not. And you accumulate negatives and you pretty much have an idea what, you know, what to do, all right, about the concept. And I apply that to a lot of things. Subtraction is vastly more robust than addition. Say in a complex system, you take an action. It will have multiple unintended consequences. You see, in a complex system, things are very unpredictable. You will know how unpredictable the war of George W., all right, cost us between 20 and 120 times more than planned initially. Okay, you get the idea. So mistakes are big in a complex system because there are a lot of things you don't see. But same thing with drugs. You add drugs to the human body, you don't know the multiple side effects that may come out of it. But but if you stop someone from smoking, you're pretty sure he's not going to have negative side effects in the long run. Okay? On balance. So if you remove something unnatural from an environment, it's vastly more effective than adding. Okay? And that's more robust. So people won't like it in medicine. Well, effectively, if you stop people from smoking, you know, no pharma will ever make money from it. But, of course, you have, you save more lives than everything. Almost every drug discovered since penicillin, cumulatively. Almost every drug cumulatively, you know. So you save more lives. For example, to cure diabetes, instead of all these research protocols that are good for keeping people busy, you should starve someone for 6 weeks. And no side effect, and typically you may end up with a very, you know, the most effective cure for diabetes. All right. So this is what I discuss in that book. And also about mistakes people make by always adding. Because the consultant, the specialist wants to add, and the politician, hey, look what I did for you. You see? Reducing is not sexy. You get the idea. Well, you know, preventing is not, doesn't work. So this is what I call via negativa. It's very important. And in it, I have that chapter that became popular on how do you forecast. Most people forecast by via positiva, by taking the present as baseline and adding to it things, like flying motorcycles and all kind of stuff, all right? Effectively, the best way to forecast, you take the present and you remove from it everything, you know, for the next 25 years, remove anything discovered the past 25 years, you see? And this is a way I link time and fragility. Time is the only judge of fragility. So, time is smarter than us. We have this notion that reason can understand stuff. It doesn't work that way. And effectively show how things deemed irrational but have been practiced for a long time, odds are, will outlive those who call them irrational, you see. Namely, things like religion. It seems irrational for some people, but you know, we don't understand how it works, why people like it, why people want it. Of course, there's a debate between Fat Tony and Socrates. This idea of anti-fragile was effectively discovered by Nietzsche. Nietzsche viewed that Socrates disrupted this balance between the Apollonian, you know, which is the rational in us, and the deep force, the Dionysian, this deep force, opaque, we don't quite understand it. And the disruption came after Socrates, with everybody trying to intellectualize things and discounting the Dionysian. So Fat Tony goes in and starts cross-examining Socrates. So out-Socratizing Socrates, out-Socrates, Socrates. And Fat Tony, with his Brooklyn accent, you understand, a guy from Brooklyn who's fat and squeezes people is definitely not going to have the last word with Socrates. And he tell him, you think that everything, that things you don't understand are stupid. That was his idea. So they are deep things, and effectively only time can understand them. So if you look at the representation of fragile, anti-fragile, only time can understand, you know, what works. And the best judge of fragility. So that's sort of the chapter. And if you want to look in the future, you remove anything recent. We'll have new technologies. We don't know what they are. Nobody forecasts the internet or this iPhone. And so, you know, it was not a forecast, or few forecast something similar, you see. But it's easy to say, I take whatever is fragile in the present, remove it, and that will be the future, plus something I don't know. And if any technology that's 25 years old will have 25 more years to go. But if it's 3,000 years old, believe me, it may have 3,000 to go. That's the idea. And then I discuss medicine a little more. The human body likes variations and stuff like that, and how we're weakening it by over-medicating the mildly ill and under-medicating the very ill. And why? Because there are a lot more, 5,000 more people mildly ill than very ill. That's the problem. And you're never going to make money just focusing on the very ill. So you have to make to over-treat the mildly ill. Now the problem is, if you're mildly ill, you have little upside from treatment and a lot of downside from side effects. Okay, and that's how I put it in the context of fragility. Now finally, my last book, the most emotional, is about skin in the game. Some people fragilize society by having their upside, bankers, and transferring downside to us. At no point in history have we had more people who have positions of power without skin in the game. They harm others. But take the economics establishment. These people are so, it's a great, very successful career. What? He published in these journals. So it's like a closed circle. When they make a mistake, they're not harmed by it. And when you're not harmed by your own mistakes, you are ethically uncalibrated. So this is how I approach things. And of course, bankers are not harmed by their mistakes. We are harmed. That April 15, you know what happens April 15? You write a check, no? Well, you're paying for the mistakes of bankers. Okay. We're backstopping them. We have the downside. They have the upside. But you generalize the society by saying that there's those who transfer fragility to others. They have the upside. They transfer downside. Those who are calibrated, they eat their own cooking. And those who, in fact, the saints, the heroes, are those who risk their lives for others. Now, the last category has disappeared in power. You know, when you hear about Mr. Petraeus, I thought when he was a general, I went on the Wikipedia page after the scandal and I saw all these decorations. I thought that he climbed walls at night, threw grenades, crossed ponds, you know, got injured, you know, went into enemy territory, all that kind of stuff. It turned out that the gentleman never took risks physically. He was just a desk, had a desk job. Well, this was the first generation of people who had positions of power without having taken personal risks. Okay, well, remember Hannibal first in battle, George Washington. Think of, you know, the history of mankind where people of power trade their power for risk. You say, okay, the only way someone can be better than me is if he's risking his life for my sake. Or even, you know, dying for the sake of others. So now we have firefighters, they'll get no respect. Bankers, firefighters have nothing but downside, no upside. Bankers have all the upside for themselves, transfer downside to us. And of course, maybe you don't have it in the technology area, but you look at corporations, of course, they're gamed. The CEO is no entrepreneur. He has little personal downside. And of course, we have bureaucratizing the whole process. So that's sort of my last one. A chapter with some tricks and heuristics about how to remedy it, to force skin in the game, that nobody should be in position to harm others without risk for himself. And my ethos is that I never tell people what to do, because if it's a mistake, I'm not harmed. I just tell people what I do. Okay? People don't understand why I'm talking about myself in a book that's technical. It's because ethically, I cannot tell you what to do. I just can tell you what I've done. And effectively, if you go to the doctor and tell him, doctor, what would you do if you were me? You'd get a different answer. You see? And in fact, we know that doctors, how they treat themselves differently from the way they treat the rest of the population. That's sort of like the general idea of fragile, more downside than upside, anti-fragile, more upside than downside. And you have the ethical problem where you're transferring downside to others. And this, these are the seven books. And, of course, in the end, I again explain the anti-fragile is what loves variations, loves things, loves randomness, loves irregularity, or needs it. You know, we're made for a stochastic environment, not getting three meals a day with cereals in the morning. You know, the lion hunts, and when they miss a hunt, their eyesight improves. You see? We're not made for smooth surfaces. We're made to look at things as variation. Nature has a lot of variation all the time. Lush, okay, nothing smooth like this. So, effectively, you know, this is good architecture, but if you see these modernistic structures, they're like devoid of information. So it creates some anxiety. So anyway, so I say the best way to check if you're alive is if you like variation. And if you really want to understand the point, there's no liquid in the world that's more pleasurable. And no money can ever buy anything as pleasurable as a glass of water for someone who just crossed a part of the Sahara Desert, you see. So this is when you understand the value of variation. The mathematical property is called Jensen's inequality, pervading the book, but I don't say it's mathematical. There's, you know, a mathematical addendum on the web, 400 pages so far. And so I won't make you read it, but I can answer your questions concerning this topic. And I'm extremely happy with this book for one reason. Because in past books, people, you know, started theorizing. This one is very simple. I get mail from someone who picks up on the idea And then suddenly says, oh, it's so obvious, and then finds an example, a story, personal story, linked to the notion of antifragility, the antifragile that they haven't seen before. So it to me, it's a success because I'm giving someone, I'm not giving someone a recipe, but I'm giving someone sort of a nudge, and they make their own recipes. So it's much more comforting for an author than giving someone a theory. You see, just a nudge for them to find their own way of thinking, to view the world with this dimension. Because remember, half of life is antifragile. Okay? And let's start talking about it. Thank you for listening to me. Please raise your hand as you're asking the question so I know who's asking it. Thanks. Yeah, we give priority to people with beard and another one for people who are bald. So it looks good here. Typically, you know, it's nothing with people with hair who ask questions. Yeah, let's go.
Yeah, you might call me Fat Tony. I'm from the other end of Flatbush Avenue, and it's Brooklyn Poly, not NYU. I have degrees from both. So here they just have a Brooklyn Avenue. They don't know Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
I grew up there. I'd like to raise some questions. Your book's fascinating. You're a great writer. But I think one thing you'll find, I'm sure you know what TRIZ is.
You're what, sorry?
TRIZ, Thomas Richard Isaac Zebra, the method of invented problem solving. Just Google it. My friend made $5 billion running a company doing that.
Oh, okay.
I'm a master of Benford's Law. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Okay.
About finding fraud by counting digits. But I think you have a mistake that I made. I'm a solid-state physicist. Disorder is the opposite of symmetry. Let me give you an example. If you take a crystal and a liquid, and I'd like your comment on this, because I greatly respect what you write, and I've begun to get interested in philosophy and psychology in my old age. I'm about 70. If you look at a crystal and a liquid, you think the crystal's more symmetric, and the liquid's more disordered, but it's the other way around. It took me 2 PhDs to learn that.
Excuse me, sir, what is your question?
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, my question is, could you have disorder? A disordered system is more symmetric.
The way I define disorder, I mean, you can define disorder the way you want. I define disorder the conventional way, and as equivalent to, as the opposite of order. Therefore, disorder as a degree of randomness in any given system. That's my definition of disorder.
But it turns
out... You can have your own definition of disorder. That's the definition of disorder I use.
Just one comment. A disordered system is more symmetric than an ordered system. It took me 2 PhDs to realize that.
Thank you. I'll look into it. Thank you very much. So another question?
Yeah, you said in your book that you're not comfortable with all the implications of what you wrote. And I was wondering if you could share with us a little bit about some of the challenging or more disturbing things.
Yeah. I was very disturbed writing this book initially because of Darwinism, and I don't like Darwinism. I'm you know, of two minds. I like social justice, you see, so you want to find solutions. And my solution is that you should have variations, but no extreme harm, you see. And the most disturbing part is that, you know, it gives me sort of what I call the barbell solution to things. That you cannot make an omelet without breaking eggs. Now you want to make sure which eggs you're breaking. And it's an ethical dilemma. Okay, who needs to be harmed? And it looks like it's people in the middle who have not been harmed, who needs to be pay the price of progress. The very weak we need to protect, you see. The very strong we need to not, completely defang, you know, because they generate growth. It's those in the middle that need to help out a little bit. And that's more comforting than I thought as a solution. But you're right, we cannot today talk about nature as something always good. It's called the naturalistic fallacy. Nature is ruthless and doesn't care about the weak. You see, and it breaks for improvement. So that was bothering me about my ideas, but at the same time, because I first start with social, with the idea notion of justice, and then later on think about growth. You see, so I'm bothered, but I have to report that I'm bothered, but that, you know, we have to follow nature in as many things as we can, except in the ethical domain, and therefore we need to overprotect the weak. All right, thanks. Great question. Yes.
Hi. Can your ideas be applied to economic theory such as Keynesianism versus Austrian economics? And what is your opinion of indefinite QE?
Okay.
In its impact, fragile, anti-fragile.
Okay. I'm definitely not going to comment on current conditions simply because I don't want some Bloomberg journalist to write headline, Taleb says this on QE, talking to Town Hall when I'm presenting my book. One day I lectured on elephants and robustness, and someone asked me a question on debt, and then the headline was, Taleb says we shouldn't do QE1 or QE whatever. So people don't know. So I'm not going to talk, but I'll let you guess what my position is with respect to what you just asked. But I'm going to talk about the problem is between the classical problem is those who believe the markets are smart but the government's stupid, and those who think that governments are smart and markets stupid. You agree? And this is, to me, is a completely wrong problem. It's not the size of the unit. Fragility increases with size. There's something I call concavity of orders. For example, a 100 million pound project in the UK will have 30% more cost overruns than a $5 million project. So therefore, it's not so much the type of government as the size of government, and municipal works a lot better than top-down. So is it Hayekian? Maybe, maybe not. Is it Keynesian? No, maybe if you have your own village, you can do your own monetary whatever. You get the idea. It's the size of unit. And I think it's a big mistake that people overlook is have all these conversations about politics without looking at the data. The data shows bigger variation when you have governance as size of a unit. City-state system works so much better as collection than nation-state. And that's the idea. The other one is that for a system to work rather well, you have a lot of decision-making should be split into a lot of small parts, not concentrated. And an anti-fragile system is a system that learns from errors. So, for example, the restaurant business, the safety business, or the safety, every time a bridge collapses, the probability of another bridge collapsing is lower. You see, whereas when a bank collapses, the probability of another bank collapsing is higher. You see, so here we have systems that are robust and even anti-fragile. They learn from mistakes. They convert mistakes into fuel for improvement, and businesses that convert mistakes into greater mistakes, you see. And I think that we are in a situation today where you have two big top-down government, and they make few mistakes, but the last two mistakes they made in the U.S., one is that war, and the second one is that crisis, right, which came straight from overstabilizing monetary policies, you see. And I don't want to stop people from making mistakes, but you want smaller, more mistakes we can learn from, not big mistakes that are almost so hard we can't learn from.
Nassim Nicholas Taleb, the author of Anti-Fragile, Things That Gain from Disorder. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on December 12, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. Emily Eagle recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the French American School of Puget Sound, committed to challenging students.